So today is going to be interesting. So what I'm going to talk about today is partly experiment. We have a fluid mechanics lab at the Curran Institute that Steve Childress and I started. And so I'll talk about some of the work that comes out of there, and I'll also talk about some of the modeling and simulation work that came out consequentially in trying to understand some of the things that we were seeing experimentally. And as you'll see in a second, this is actually our version of a flag flapping in the wind. And as Dave said, the flapping of a flag is a very classical problem in hydrodynamics. Why does it flap? What determines the frequency of flapping? What are the physical effects that come in? And in fact, as a question of debate, the flapping of flags has occupied minds for centuries. And this is the first, I should say that I don't do experiments. So I'll say that first off. The person in this effort that does experiments is a fellow named Jun Zhang from the mainland of China. And every Chinese school child learns about a famous parable, but really it's not a parable, it's a real story apparently that happened. And it's called the incident at Vajing Temple, which is occurred in 676 AD. And what it involved was a group of monks in debating the question about why a flag flaps. And one, you can see the two of them here in the center, and this is actually June's drawing. Besides being a very gifted experimentalist, he's a very fine artist as well. And one says, "Look, the flag is flapping." And the reply of his debater is, "No, it's the wind that moves." All right, so the point about this whole story is it's a fluid, the question is the flag, from the second point of view, just an object which is reflecting what's going on in the fluid as the fluid is going around it, or instead, is the flag somehow flapping of its own accord? Obviously, the fluid needs to be there where the flag doesn't move, but is it cooperating with the fluid somehow? Are they exchanging something, say inertia, and that's what's making it flap? Now, given that this has apparently been debated for centuries, one may ask why I'm giving this talk to you today. And by way of answering that, at least for these Buddhist monks, is that a Buddhist master happened to be listening the debate, and he stopped it. And he said, "Both of you are wrong. It is neither the flag that flaps nor the wind that moves. It is your mind that moves." And of course, then you repose it. The point of view is as something that has to do with mind rather than some sort of physical reality, and kind of the scientific questions stop at that point, or they can. And so it had to wait for quite a while for Lord Rayleigh. So Lord Rayleigh was a great physicist, mathematician, and he was looking at the problem in, oh, I think it was 1876. He was studying the Kelvin-Helmholtz. Oh, I have a date up here, 1879. He was studying the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, which I told you a bit about. And he thought about the particular instance where the, let me put up a picture here. He thought about the particular instance where instead of having some mean jump in the velocity of these two masses of fluid sliding past each other, he thought about the case where the mean jump was zero. There may be small-scale jumps in the slip at this interface of this vortex sheet, but the two masses of fluid are moving with the same velocity in bulk. And what he discovered in this very seminal paper in which he examined all sorts of aspects of the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability was that in that particular case, you could still have an instability. It wasn't an instability where you had an exponential growth in the linear problem, but rather one where you had a linear growth in time. And he makes the comment that the peculiarity of this case is that previous to the displacement, there is no real surface of separation at all. So he's really thinking of this object as not being a material object, so to speak, but as just some slip line in the flow that, in the case where the two, if it were flat and the two masses of fluid are moving at the same velocity, you wouldn't know it was there, right? It would just be some virtual surface in the fluid. And then he remarks, its bearing upon the flapping of sails and flags will be evident. Now, what that means in this very formal style of English writing is not that he's going to make it evident to you on the next page, but rather it should already be evident to you and he's going to move on. So so what he did then, Lord Rayleigh, is he conceived of the flag as just some jump in the fluid across which the tangential velocity was not continuous, it jumped. And in fact, he considered the case here where actually the stress across this surface was continuous, so there was no stress jump. And in that case, it became a special case of the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, which gave a linear growth. And this is what he attributed. This was the physical effect, he thought, that underlaid the flapping of flags. Now, his argument, let me say some things about it. The first thing is that it turns out that if you look at this argument, it implies that a disturbance of any size will grow. All right? So no matter, for example, how short or long your flag is, it will always become unstable. If you have a flat flag and a laminar flow going by, you put a little bump into it, it will always grow and the flag will begin to flap, presumably. Now, it also invokes no flag inertia. So the flag is as he says, is not a real surface at all. It has no mass per unit length as a real flag might. It has no rigidity or flexibility. It's perfectly flexible. It just has to move the fluid around. It doesn't invoke fluid viscosity or the fact that the material of the flag, like a sheet of paper, may be inextensible, and that can create tensions in the flag. Nor does it explain where the vorticity may be coming from that's moving this object around. Now, so...
Excuse me, yes. Michael. Supposing you take the flag out, is that discontinuity still there in the flow of the fluid?
Well, here's the funny thing. You have a conservation law for the Euler equations. And it says that the circulation density is convected with the fluid. So if you have any vorticity in the flow, it had to come from somewhere. It doesn't get created. So that's the point here. What is it that initially gave this slip? All right, you could have a flat flag and you put some slip on it, right, and it will evect, but it had to come from somewhere. There's no mechanism for producing it. So that's one question about what would be the source of the circulation, say, that might actually start things moving around.
Could be the flagpole, for example.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's, of course, not invoked in Rayleigh's explanation. But it could be exactly this, that you always have lofted this flag from a pole. And we know very well that there's eddies that are shed off of a pole as the wind goes around it. All right, and that could be a source for the flapping. But now I'm going to ask a different question. So that's right. What happens if you take Rayleigh at his word and you have no pole? All right? What happens then? So there's no source of vorticity. It's just the surface sitting there in a laminar fluid. No other sources of circulation. It can only generate it by itself. That question. So what we did was, of course, first go out and see what had been done. So here's the first question. Is a flat flag in a laminar flow always unstable to flapping? That's one of the consequences of Rayleigh's argument. And in fact, if you talk to fluid mechanicians, such as myself a few years ago, and someone said, well, why does a flag flap? And you'd say, well, didn't Rayleigh solve that problem in 1879? You know, it's a special case of the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And so now, how true is that, really? So is a flat flag in a laminar flow always unstable to flapping? Let's take him at his word. If it's not, why not? What are the physical effects that would make it not unstable? If it's unstable, what controls the behavior? And so then you go and ask, well, what experiments have been done? And I say practically none, but really none. It's amazing. For such a absolutely classical problem, you see flags, of course, in states. You see flags a lot these days. But, you know, nobody has really done serious experiments on the dynamics of flags. Now, what are some of the difficulties with doing experiments? Well, one is that really Rayleigh's explanation is a two-dimensional explanation. You're really thinking about infinitely wide flag. Maybe it has some finite span. So you're just thinking about a two-dimensional fluid. So one would be contamination of 3D flow effects. Of course, they're always there. Flow visualization is difficult to do. So we decided to cheat a little bit. And June constructed the following experiment, where we used a soap film as a stand-in for a two-dimensional fluid flow. And so we built the following experimental device. You have a reservoir of soapy water up here, and it pours down through a spigot, and then that solution spreads between two fishing lines that are drawn, I think, 10 centimeters apart typically, something on that order, and it runs down a few feet and then exits down at the bottom. Its flow speed is somewhere between 2 to 4 meters per second. And what we do is in that running stream, well, let me just say something first. It turns out that running soap films behave remarkably like two-dimensional viscous fluids. They have turbulence statistics that look very much like the predictions of 2D turbulence for two-dimensional fluids. Lots of experiments have been done these days at looking at using soap films as kind of substrates for understanding 2D flows. So they can be, they have their limitations. You have to worry about things like surface elasticity, some things that you don't have in a real 2D fluid, but they behave remarkably like them. Okay, so what we do is we suspend in this soap film a little piece of thread, silken thread. We hold it there, and we let the fluid flow around it. And so let me show you a movie of what happens in that. Let's see. Hopefully this all goes. All right. Now, there's a flapping flag in a 2D running soap film. It's gone. There it is. So actually, what you're... Let me back up a little bit, because I just want to tell you what you just saw. So this object is flapping at about 50 hertz or so. So it's very fast. So it's actually being filmed through a strobe lamp. Okay? Thing has to do a lot of work. All right. There we go. So you're not seeing the true motion is what I'm trying to say. You're seeing it sampled. So if it looks a little funny, like sometimes the waves are moving up rather than back, the flow is actually going from left to right. It's being held up here. Now here's the flag again. Yeah, sorry, this tape is a little fussy. There's the flag again. Flow's moving from right to left. Let's see if we can get it right here. So you can see the sampling makes it, there's actually waves that are moving down the flag just like you expect it to in a real fluid, but because of the sampling that comes from the strobe lamp, all right, now watch this. There's the flapping flag. June's hand, the hand of God, comes in, stops it, and it's flat. A stable, flat, flapping flag. Apparently contrary to Rayleigh's prediction. More than that, by stability. So simultaneous flapping periodic states coexisting with flat, stable states. You have to give it a largish perturbation to get it to go into this flapping state. There it goes again. Now what you can't see right here is actually there's a beautiful vortex streak coming off the back of this flag. I'll tell you what you're actually seeing, what these lines mean when I throw a transparency up. Maybe I'll do on this other, while you're watching that, I'll do that over here.
There it is. Just showed it.
Yeah. All right, there. There's a nice one. Now, this is, Jung builds these beautiful experimental measuring environments where onto a single screen he manages to get something that's recording the displacement of the end so he can look at the frequency and amplitude of the flashing. He also does drag measurements. Those are two flags held side by side. So if you like, that's flow in a compliant tube. Now they're a little bit further apart. This is very ethereal. First you think you're seeing it in some weird stereoscopic effect. Now they're flapping actually not together, but out of phase with each other. Exactly one half period out of phase. There we go. Now this is someplace they're getting further apart. They kind of see each other, but they're not sure. Ah, stable flat states again. Kind of slamming together there. There we go.
So he's got a thin layer of fluid on the surface of our glass.
I'll describe it a little bit better, I think. So this is actually a freestanding film. All right? So it's just like the surface of a bubble, but now instead it's held between two fishing lines that are holding the ends. So the film's just running down. This is the plane of the film, running from right to left in this picture. And it's running down around these filaments. These filaments are wet into the film. They're embedded in it. So it's like they're within the film. Does that make sense?
You said down, so it kind of ramp.
I'm sorry?
You said it's running down.
Well, here it's moving from, it depends on how you tilt the camera, but it's a gravity drive, so.
Well, that's what I was asking.
Yeah.
So it's vertical.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's just being pulled down by gravity. And what happens is that the air drag on the two sides of the film as it falls down gives it a terminal velocity. Okay. Now, that terminal velocity is also related to the mass flux, so you can adjust that a bit by the mass flux at the top. So then you can play with the velocity in that way. So across this soap film, you actually have a rather uniform flow because of this air drag. All right, so this is, move that over here since. So in this picture, gravity's down in this direction, and that's what's driving this whole flow down. So this is the experimental side of this. We published in a Nature paper just about a year ago now, last December. And so here's a picture of the bistable state that I showed you. All right? Now let me tell you what you're actually seeing here. These lines that you're seeing, those are lines of constructive or destructive interference of light. So I have this very thin soap film. You hit it with a single frequency light source, sodium lamp. Some of the light reflects off the front surface and some off the back surface of the soap film. And then you get an interference effect depending on the soap film thickness. And so you can see that what this is telling you is that the soap film thickness is actually changing as a function of flow and other things. And that allows you to actually visualize some of the dynamical aspects of the flow. So, for example, what you see here is you can see a boundary layer running down, okay, around this thing, and then you're shedding a bunch of vortices. Now, why might you be able to see vortices? Well, a vortex, it turns out, has a local pressure load typically at the center. All right, so it has a lower pressure in the center than outside of the vortex. That changes the film thickness. All right. And so you see these vortex pairs being shed off. Here, where it starts to flap, you get this beautiful sinuous wake, which, by the way, is growing with more or less linear growth. which is perhaps one aspect of Rayleigh's explanation that is correct. Now, but the main thing, you can have stable flags. This is actually along the bottom here. This is actually putting a bit of a fluorescent dye onto the tip of the flag and looking at it as it flaps. And the fact that it goes through this figure eight is telling you, for one thing, that this is basically an inextensible object. It's got some sort of sinuous envelope of flapping, but because of the inextensibility, the end will actually execute a figure eight if you have a sine wave inside of some envelope for the displacement. So there's that. And then these are the, this is the what I call the flow in a compliant channel. So one of my themes of my work is talking about the interaction of flows with compliant bodies. So, it's so sticky. So what you see in this case is, for example, in this flow in a compliant channel, that when they're close together, they tend to oscillate. If they're not in a flat state, they tend to oscillate in register. As you pull them apart, they go into out of phase oscillation, where they're kind of slamming together and then releasing big droplets of fluid, and slamming together, releasing big droplets of fluid. And there you see two halves of that cycle in B and C. So these are really some of the first very clean experiments in which you can see a lot of the details for the way in which a flexible object interacts with a high-speed flow, high Reynolds number flow. And you can measure things like drag, you can visualize the flow. We use something called laser Doppler velocimetry, where we see the flow with little particles, and then we can use a laser setup to measure the speed at points in the flow using these particles as seeds. You can do quite a lot. So here's the result of some of these measurements. And what I want to show you is the bistability and the hysteretic behavior in this system. So what you're looking at is a sequence, a single experiment, but a sequence of measurements. I start off with a flag. And I should say, I start off with a flag of a certain length. I should call it a string. It's not really a flag. We call it a flag. But there's the way this is injected into the fluid, so to speak, is that there's a tube, and the string is threaded to it, through it, comes out the end, and the tube isn't actually sticking into the fluid, so there's no big flagpole sitting there, and the string kind of gets pulled down into the fluid by the running stream. And then we can shove more flag through the tube and make it longer. We can pull it back and make it shorter. So that's our control parameter in this problem, is the length of the flag. So, start off with a rather short flag. I think we're down here around 2 centimeters or something like that, going up to about 5. And you lengthen it. So here we are looking at the frequency of the flapping. And you can see in the flat state, of course, there's no frequency. It could either be zero or infinite, whatever you want to call it. There's no frequency. And at some point, we reach a critical value, apparently, at which the flat state does not persist. It jumps up into a flapping state. You keep going up along this path, and it's got a more or less flat frequency. And as you draw back down, you don't go back down to the flat state as you go along this route. Rather, you come back along maintaining a flapping state until at some point you just become too short and you go back to being flat. All right? That's the frequency of flapping. If you look at the amplitude of flapping, again, you see a rather weak dependence of the amplitude, not entirely, but rather weak dependence of the amplitude on the length. Okay. What you also tend to find is that as you draw this out and you make it longer and longer, the part which is flapping is confined to the end. All right. So if you make it longer, then you'll just have a flat piece with a flapping tail, holding about 1 or 1.5 wavelengths. Now, that makes some sense, actually, because this object is being pulled down by gravity, it's being pulled down by fluid stresses, like viscous stresses and so forth, but it's inextensible. Since it's inextensible, it develops a greater tension up here at the top, because it has to hold that point fixed against all the forces that are pulling it down. And that's a stabilizing effect in this. So if you make it longer and longer, this tension in the flag up here just grows bigger and bigger, and that will keep it straight. All right, so one question here. Okay, so first of all, we've seen there's a flat state, contrary to Rayleigh's prediction, and moreover, we have some sort of bifurcation. And so now the question is, what kind of bifurcation is this? Is it truly a loss of stability of the flat state? Maybe this whole range is actually stable, but the domain size, the stability around that flat state is getting vanishingly small as I increase the length, and I just have some finite amplitude effect which is kicking it out, and it goes into this other state. Maybe there really is a loss of stability. If there's a real loss of stability, then what's the nature of the bifurcation? It looks like kind of a hop type bifurcation. So I'm going to answer the first two parts of that, but the last weights more work. All right, so results. The flat flag is apparently stable for sufficiently short lengths. There's an apparent loss of stability at a critical wavelength L sub C, and there's bistability in the sense that there's coexistence of flat and flapping states at the same value of length. All right, so here's the question. What's going on? So let me provide some partial, I believe are partial answers, though this is not a done deal by any stretch as yet. And so what I'm going to describe is some unpublished analysis of Steve and myself. And what we're going to do is to consider the flag, again, as a vortex sheet. Like Rayleigh did, a surface of discontinuity. But what we're going to do now is we're going to allow that surface to have a stress jump. And we're going to relate that stress jump to mechanical properties of this object that we've put into the flow. And we'll see what happens then. Okay, so let me first say, we're going to look at it in an inviscid flow, so no viscosity. All right? I should tell you that the Reynolds numbers of these flows are around 10,000, so it's rather high. So here's the picture. I have a vortex sheet here. It's finite length. It's got a wake being shed behind it. Some slip surface is being shed behind it. And there's some oncoming velocity. And so we're going to describe this sheet as having a position, x of st. I'll use s now as a material variable, dynamical variable of the flow, because it's inextensible. So s is a material property, is a material length of this inextensible object. There's some slip across it. There's a stress jump, which I'll have to describe. Now, in the outer flow off of the sheet, I'm going to describe this, as I said, by an inviscid flow, so I'm dealing with the Euler equations. Okay, so that's mass and momentum balance again. A velocity and a pressure and a divergence-free condition. And that's just 2D in the plane. And I'm going to have a pressure jump across this surface. I'm going to allow a stress jump, so I'll call that bracket P. And I'll remind you I have this vortex sheet strength, which is related to which is exactly the jump in tangential velocity at that surface, and I call that gamma. And then I have this kinematic boundary condition that says that this surface has to move with the normal fluid the normal component of fluid velocity on either side, and those two have to be equal. All right, so I throw up some equations. And again, this is that vortex sheet reduction of the Euler equations to just the dynamics of a curve with these Birkhoff-Rod integrals that I described two lectures ago. And it's an exact reduction of the Euler equations to the dynamics of this surface gamma. Okay? So I just want to point out a couple of things. One is that here's the dynamics. Remember, I have a normal velocity that comes from the physics, and I have some sort of tangential velocity. I use that to enforce arc length being the dynamical variable of the sheet. And then I have a transport equation for this surface vorticity or vortex sheet strength. So this is just a transport term. It's like a convection or advection equation. This is the term that produces circulation on the sheet or produces more jump. This is the term that Rayleigh does not have. Okay, it's the surface derivative of the pressure jump. In Rayleigh's, that was zero. And so the velocity is then produced by a Birkhoff-Rott integral, which I described before, which is a Cauchy-type integral evaluated along the surface against this vortex sheet strength. And this is just a background flow, this x hat, which is moving to the right. And so W is the velocity as a function of vortex sheet strength. All right, so what I've done now is I've written down almost all the dynamics, but I haven't told you what specifies the pressure jump, which has to drive the circulation production. So this is where it gets interesting. So this surface gets moved around by the fluid stresses and perhaps by its own dynamics as well. And so what moves it around are jumps in stress from the fluid. That's what exerts a force on this object. All right? The only stress I have in this problem is the normal stress or the pressure. And so what the dynamics is that the stress jump on the surface, which is producing circulation, is balanced by the mechanical properties of that surface. So its inertia, its rigidity, its tension. All right, so now I'm writing that equation, which is just the dynamics of an elastic rod, which has a normal jump and a pressure, which is moving it around. And that's coming from the fluid. I've non-dimensionalized things, so I have two non-dimensional parameters. This would usually be some sort of density, S1, and this would usually be an elastic rigidity, and I call that S2. So here I have three parts. It's saying that the acceleration of the rod, all right, is given by its rigidity. There's an elastic response force, its axial tension, as well as by the normal stress jump, which acts in the normal direction to the surface. So that's what moves it around. Okay, now, what are these non-dimensional parameters? They're interesting parameters. So first of all, let me say, I'm going to assume that my surface has a length L. I said that on the previous slide, which I should probably just put up. And maybe I didn't, but I will nonetheless put this up here. So this object here, the flag, has a length L, and I've non-dimensionalized it to have the length 1. And so this parameter that sits in front of the acceleration term of the flag is the ratio of the mass of the flag to the mass of the fluid over the length scale with which the flag interacts with the fluid. And so I call that L squiggle. That's just a scaled length. There's a 2 pi floating around. So the mass of the flag is its mass per unit length times the length divided by the density of the fluid times the film thickness times an area L squared. That's a control parameter. The other control parameter in this, it turns out to be the ratio of the elastic energy of the flag to the kinetic energy of the fluid over a scale with which it interacts with the fluid. And so that's this E is the bending rigidity, which I introduced before. It's the elastic rigidity of this piece of string, if you can assign such a quantity to it. E over L has the units of energy, so I call that elastic energy. And then this is rho F L squared U squared. That's the kinetic energy of the fluid. All right. So let me just say, if you go to the experiments and you look at the bifurcation point, what these non-dimensional parameters, what values do they take? This S1, which is, if you like, it's the measure of the importance of the inertia of the flag to the inertia of the fluid, is order 1. So it appears that at the bifurcation point, the inertia of the flag has come into balance with the inertia of the fluid. It's an important player in what's going on. And then this parameter is rather small, but is probably providing a length scale for you. It's an elastic response. And so if you take a look at the way these are defined, when L is very small, both S1 and S2 become very large. And so when the length is very small, the non-dimensional equations are telling you that the pressure drops out. And this basically just looks like the dynamics of an elastic rod. It doesn't feel the fluid when it's very short. Elastic rods, which are just hanging there, don't do anything except for wiggle around if you wiggle them. They don't become unstable. So this already tells you that you might have a stable state sitting in here when it becomes sufficiently short. So now let me tell you something which is interesting about these equations. Yes, that was my preamble. All right. So one is the following. I've described the velocity of the flag in terms of this velocity u. That's the normal velocity that comes from this Birkhoff-Rod integral. So u is, that's n. That's the normal dotted with this w. All right? So I've described the velocity of the flag through something that depends on gamma, or through the vorticity in the flow. And I've described the way in which vorticity or circulation is produced in terms of the stress jump. So I have an equation for dx dt. What I just did here is I just gave another equation by asking, I have some sort of mechanical force balance on the flag. I've given an equation now for the acceleration as well. I seem to be having too many equations floating around. All right? But what's not determined is that pressure jump. And so the way in which you determine the stress jump in these problems is that you have to ask that those two descriptions are consistent. You have to rationalize them. And that gives you an equation or a condition on determining the stress jump. So that's an interesting point in this. So all I'm going to do for you today is to linearize these equations and see what they tell you. I want to know about the stability of a flat state. Now, and I'm going to cheat. I'm going to do a lot of cheating. What I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that I have an infinitely long flag. All right? And I want to linearize that object. So I'm not going to have a wake. I'm going to have a flow going past it above and below. But I'm just going to look at this mass-bearing surface in a flow and see what its stability properties are. So now I linearize my equations, and let me just tell you what they are. Eta here is just the, as you can see here, I'm going to assume that x, the position, is just given by a coordinate x, and then a small displacement eta is a function of x and t. And this epsilon is going to be much smaller than 1. So I'm going to be looking at just what's the dynamics of small displacements from being flat. And the size of that is epsilon eta. So I linearize my equations around the flat state to order epsilon. Flat state is an exact solution of my dynamics equations. So here's what it looks like. My Elastica equation just linearizes to a high-order wave equation, so to speak, with four derivatives, an Elastica equation with the pressure driving. The tension turns out, I should say, what the hell is the tension? The tension is, again, that object that enforces the inextensibility of the flag. Turns out that drops out at leading order. Now, of course, you have to say, what does it mean to have a displacement for an infinitely long thing that will preserve the length of the ground state? But we put that under the rug and drop it. Now, this is what happens to those two fluid dynamical equations right here when I linearize around the flat state. I have eta t plus eta x is equal to 1/2 the Hilbert transform of gamma. That's what happens to this fellow here. This is an advection equation, right? And I have a velocity of 1, which is just the non-dimensionalized background velocity of a flow. This Hilbert transform is what survives of this nonlinear Birkhoff-Rod integral when I linearize it. And here it is here. It's this principal value of f of its argument over x minus x prime. The vortex sheet strength, or gamma, again looks like a linear advection equation with now the surface gradient of the pressure replaced by its x derivative. So the interesting thing about this is that now you can see that you have two, there are really two different things going on here. These equations are advection equations. That's because they come from the fluid mechanics, and the fluid mechanics is described as being a perturbation against a background flow. So I have advective terms, these A to X terms. This is a mechanical force balance equation where the arc length is a material point on the curve, and it's being held fixed in a frame. The flow is going past it, and so it has no advective terms. It's just an Elastica equation. It's being held there fixed against the flow. And so now you see I have an equation for acceleration, an equation for velocity, than this guy, and I have to use this unknown, which shows up in these two equations, the first and the third, in order to rationalize those two descriptions. And you can do that, and what you can show is that by asking that these two descriptions both describe the inertial dynamics of this object means that this eta has to satisfy an integral differential equation, this displacement. And here it is here. It's a rather nasty thing. So eta satisfies this equation. It's got an advection term now, but with two components. It has non-locality that comes from that Hilbert transform, which came from the divergence free condition. And the stresses are reflected in its arguments. There's a stress that's given by the acceleration of the flag as a mass-bearing object, and this is the stress that's given by the elastic response. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to look for solutions of this as a Fourier series. And it turns out that Hilbert transforms are just straight convolutions, and so they diagonalize under a Fourier transform. And so if I look for solutions eta, which is an amplitude times an e to the I omega t, so I'm looking for frequency, e to the I kx. Actually, I'm looking for a sum of such things, but it's separable. That turns out to reduce this set of, this integral differential equation into a quadratic eigenvalue problem for the frequency. That's all, just a quadratic eigenvalue problem. And now you stare at this. The first thing you discover is that if I start to take k small in this quadratic eigenvalue problem, it turns out that the right-hand side becomes negative. That tells me I have a long-wave instability in my problem. All right? So that's consistent with, as I draw this piece of thread out further and further, suddenly it becomes unstable. It's unstable to a long-wave instability. You need to be sufficiently long. And so the picture of the dispersion relation that's associated with this is that if you're sufficiently short, all your possible unstable modes sit beneath some fundamental scale. As you increase the length, you draw this out, and then you cross the first mode of instability, and it can go. So this system has interesting properties. You say other things about it. It has no, if you take out the advective terms, if you take out the eta x and the eta t out of these equations, so you remove the background flow from the problem, then there's only dispersive waves. There's no instability in the problem. You lose it. So it's a coupling between kind of the flow-driven effect on the outside and the fact that I'm being held against the flow as a mechanical object. If I set the mass of the flag to zero, you have only dispersive waves. There's no unstable growth again. So it's telling you that the mass of the flag is essential for getting the instability. You can't have just some weightless thing sitting there. If I set the elastic terms to zero and I keep a mass, then it turns out I'm unstable at all length scales. But it's a very different instability than what Rayleigh was talking about. This actually looks more like a Rayleigh-Taylor instability. It has an exponential growth, and the growth rates scale like k to the half. And so S1 and S2, the mass and the elasticity together, when they're both positive, will set a critical length scale in this problem for an instability for this kind of cartoon. Yes?
Maybe this is an obvious answer. If you're linearizing, so is it obvious there aren't higher order effects which make any of this wrong?
No, it's not completely obvious. But for the case of instability, then you're on safe ground. When you're stable, so that you have purely neutral modes, then you really would need to go to a higher order analysis. All right? So, yeah. In fact, you need the higher order analysis. If you get an instability, you need the higher order analysis also to say whether it's a haplotype bifurcation and things like this, which is not as yet done. And this is not a, it's not a simple ODE or PDE. It's got all these integral terms. It's non-local. It's kind of a mess. All right, so you also get a selection criterion out of this kind of cartoon of, which I think contains a lot of the physics, but out of this kind of cartoon problem, you also get a selection criterion for a critical length namely, at what point you cross the fundamental mode, you become long enough so you can start to become unstable. That's a zero discriminant condition from this quadratic eigenvalue problem. And what you find is that, given the physical parameters, then this predicts that about a length of a centimeter, you become unstable at a frequency of 90 hertz. You're in the ballpark in this game. You're not so far off. So, anyway, and here's what you get from me. In my book, this is not bad. So we're working on this, on doing fully nonlinear simulations and putting in weights and things like that. It turns out to be very, very difficult. Mostly because you have to ask how you shed vorticity into the flow from this kind of inviscid object. And that's work with Marvin Jones, who's a Courant postdoc. All right, so what the analysis does suggest is that flags should be stable for sufficiently short lengths, at least it's neutral stability. You would also think, though, that, let me put it this way, if you're in this stable regime and you kind of hit it a little bit, all right, perturbations tend to get swept downstream. So you move things into the fluid and the flag will stabilize. So there's kind of an advective stabilization in these problems as well until you become unstable. That's my belief. Now, the flag inertia, its rigidity, and the outer fluid flow together pick a critical length in this simple analysis. And other effects, so I came in with a rather short critical length. Other effects like gravity, which is pulling it down, shear stresses, which will also increase the tension, film elasticity, it turns out that those kinds of physical effects will only increase the critical length if they're included. So you're kind of headed in the right direction. And I should also say there was recent work last year by a couple of English fellows, Fit and Pope, who considered a flag but used a quasi-steady Bernoulli approximation. For those of you that know what that might mean, and no wake. To model the flag. They get an instability, but it's off by about an order of magnitude in the length. All right, so now, there have been simulations, not mine, of this in viscous flows, and this is at the Institute, a student of Charlie Peskin's using what's called the immersed boundary method, and in which what they basically do is they model the flag as a force-exerting object, rather in a similar way that I've described as a vortex sheet, now embedded in a viscous flow. And so now here the viscosity, or rather the Reynolds number is around 200. But you see many of the effects. And so what they see is, for example, in this simulation, this is showing the vorticity field. That red object is the flag. And what you see is it's shedding a wake behind it. You can see it's a much kind of more smeared out thing because the Reynolds number is much lower than the experiment. But what they find is self-sustained flapping, so consistent with the experiments, and also that they find, in consistency with this theory, that there's no flapping if you have no flag mass. All right, this guy just becomes straight and hangs there. So, if you like, it's convectively stabilized in that case, as I was just describing, as it might be. And here's some more pictures of their simulations. So on. Now, I'm showing this because this is another one of June's pretty drawings. And so what you're seeing here actually are the different kinds of wakes that you see in different types of flows. June is very interested in swimming of fish, biological locomotion. And this is, you know, if you have flow around a cylinder, then you have this alternating vortex pair that comes off of each side. It turns out that fish propel themselves by managing to change the signs on each side of these vortex pairs by the way they flap their tails. And this is the flag is some other type of behavior where it sheds off lots of little vortices into big wake structures. So there's a whole class of kind of, the wakes are very important, for example, to determine the drag on an object, what style of wake you have. Obviously, a fish is not having a relative drag. He's moving forward. So, okay. Now, I have a few more minutes. So that's the flag story as it sits now. I have a few more minutes. And what I want to do, if I can find... What did I do with it? Give me just a second. It's the chain stuff. What I wanted to do was to tell you what happens if you take the fluid out of the problem. And I alluded to this a little bit, and this is a short and sweet story. And this has to do with what's the dynamics of an object like this, say hanging in a gravitational field, but with no fluid. All right? What makes it go? Now, I started looking at the dynamics of chains from a theoretical point of view because I was trying to understand how boundary conditions get generated on objects and flows. And so I decided to get rid of the flow and look at an object just like a chain, some inextensible string that's hanging there. And so I wrote some, I did some analysis, and I figured out how boundary conditions are generated from that, from taking continuum limits of discrete models. And I was telling my friend Andrew Belmonte at Penn State about this, and he set up a little experiment to do an experimental analog of my simulations. Now, of course, being an experimentalist, he decided not to do exactly what I did, but something more interesting. So this is so what came out of this is a nice little compact physical review letter in the past couple of months of experiments in theory of what happens when you with this free boundary if you take out the surrounding fluid. So what we're looking at now is just the dynamics of an inextensible, freely jointed chain or just a perfectly flexible string as it's hanging there. Yeah. So thanks, Dave. Oops, wrong end. So it's literally like this. So Andrew took this object, not perhaps this one, but it's twin. It's American twin. And he put it on a little motor that just moved it up and down, just like this. Hey, that's nice. All right? Now, if you move this thing slowly enough, of course, I'm having a hard time not moving my arm, or rather moving my arm straight up and down. If you move it slowly enough, it basically stays nice and straight. But it turns out that there are certain places where you start pumping energy into the system, and it starts flapping around all over the place. And so what we did was a very controlled study of that. Actually, there was a nice little comment on this paper of ours in Nature in which this guy talked about how American mathematicians were using bathtub chain, you know, to do something. It was all a little insulting. But here's the picture. So what I'm showing you here are some experimental results from Andrew of what happens in different ranges of amplitude and frequency of forcing. Yes?
It's like a resonance effect.
It's exactly a resonance type effect. This is another problem like the flag that you're just surprised that nobody did it. It's, you know, it's an absolutely classical problem. It's been sitting around for centuries, actually. So, but there's lots of problems like that. It's always a little bit surprising. So, for example, we see here are actually three different types of behavior. Here is a chain that remains, has a two-dimensional pendular motion where it just goes back and forth. Here's a chaotic chain. It flaps all over the place, hits itself, it hits the pole. Looks kind of like the Gorgon's head, you know, if you stared at it, you turned to stone. And along the bottom, this is another state that we call a stellate state. And this is impossible to do by hand. But what it's doing is kind of processing around in this kind of circular state. Okay? And this is the stellate from looking from below, actually. And this is looking from the side. So as I said before, it's kind of a Spanish helmet type of flow. And so Andrew produced nice phase diagram for this. And so here, the two parameters in the problem, you have the gravity, you have the mass of the flag, you have its length, and then you have the amplitude and the frequency of forcing. So here the top is just being moved with an amplitude cosine 2 pi ft, so f is frequency. And then you can form a non-dimensional amplitude epsilon and frequency using the other physical parameters in the problem. And then he maps out these different regions. So he has regions where he has a rod-like behavior. You just move it up and down, and it behaves like a rod. Here's that pendular behavior. Here's more pendular behavior, that two-dimensional state moving back and forth. Here is very chaotic, this whole region. This is where the stellate lives. There's other behaviors you can find as well. It's very rich. And so we did. So what was this chain model? It's just the following. So it looks like that mechanical equation for the flag, but without the pressure jump and without the rigidity. And so you have XTT, now it's written non-dimensionally again, balanced against a tension force, and now I have gravity. All right, now non-dimensionalized to unit one. I have an inextensibility condition, that's very important, which says that if I take the time derivative of XS dot XS, which I know has to be zero, then more than that, I can interchange time and arc length derivatives. All right, that's inextensibility, and you can use that to generate a boundary value problem for the tension. And so here again, the tension plays the role of an axial force that keeps things from being stretched or compressed. And then non-dimensionally in this, you have, in terms of the non-dimensional parameter, so I'm bouncing up and down at the top, and then there's a no force condition on the free end, which just says that the tension is zero there. That's a boundary condition on that end. Now, you can study that equation. It turns out that if you... Oops, sorry about that. This thing gets stuck here. This equation, it turns out, if you look at this linearized problem, then you can expand it in terms of Bessel functions, and you can write it as a series of Matthew equations. So this gets to the question of having resonant instabilities. It's really described in terms of Matthew equations. And what you find by analyzing those Matthew equations is that you have a series of resonant tongues of instability. And here, they're showing the outlines of some of these tongues overlaid with the experimental profiles where those lay. Okay, so you can see we catch this first region here and this chaotic region here quite well. It gets a little messier up here. So we did, actually, and this is a fit, so to speak. It's not a fit. There are no free parameters in the problem. This is just a direct comparison of the theory from this simple nonlinear PDE that's linearized to the experimental results. Now, all right. Now, if you simulate that PDE, those are the results that you get. And you find the pendular states, you find the chaotic states, you find the stellate states. You can just kind of walk through the whole thing, and with this simple PDE, you can recover a lot of the experiment, the very nonlinear patterns from the experiment. And then you can start to look at the numerics. That's always the nice thing about numerics, is that you get to examine the numbers. You can start to find out things about these particular states. And so, for example, here's the pendulum. And what I'm showing you here is the kinetic energy of the pendulum. All right? So kinetic energy here is not an invariant because I'm always dropping this thing up and down. So what happens is that after a long time, the kinetic energy settles to this very periodic behavior where it has zeros or no kinetic energy. And what's happening is that this thing's swinging back and forth, and right at the top, this thing conspires so that every single element has no velocity at that time. It's not doing something like this, like you might expect. It's just coming down, it freezes, and then it goes down. This is something that's called a break orbit in low-dimensional Hamiltonian systems that people study the existence and properties of. And so this is a very interesting thing. It finds this break orbit. I should say, we do have to put a little bit of dissipation into the problem to stabilize all of these, as it might be in the experiment. There's the chaotic state. Now, of course, here, our string is completely free to pass through itself and all this kind of stuff. It doesn't recognize physical constraints like, oh, there's another piece of string, or there's the rod. But it looks, at least by eye, rather similar to the chaotic state that you saw in the experiment. And when you start looking at its kinetic energy, you see it's very intermittent. All right, it has kind of a quasi-periodic behavior in it, pumping energy in and out. It's leaving the system, coming back in. And then sometimes it has abrupt losses of a lot of its kinetic energy. It becomes rod-like again, and then it has to build itself back up. So there's a lot of kind of chaotic intermittent dynamics that's associated with Dampton-driven systems that people study in more complicated cases. Now, not that Andrew would let us describe everything by this simple theory. He said, yes, but can you do this? And so it turns out that one of the very interesting things that this does, and every, as I say, I wrote this sentence myself in the paper, as every sailor and parlor magician knows, that if you learn how to bounce a string right, you can get it to tie knots in itself. All right? And so when, in this problem, when you're in these chaotic states, this object is exploring all over its phase space, and it can sometimes find its way into tying a knot. All right? Things like that happen in polymers, where you have a polymer, it's in a thermal bath, it's being knocked all over the place, it's bending, and sometimes it ties itself into knots. And so it's similar in that way, but this is a very inertial case. Well, not that you just tie a simple trefoil knot. It can tie figure eights, double trefoils, and more complicated things, actually. And they come with decreasing frequency as you go towards more complicated objects. Now, at first, they only found these three, because once it would tie itself in a knot, it would just hang there because it had this weight at the end, which is why I didn't want to bounce it this way with the weight on the end. And they asked, well, why not the simple trefoil? And it turns out that the trefoil unties itself rather easily. So you tie it, and then it bounces off, and it's gone. And so anyway, that's a little bit beyond the theory. You'd have to put in things like contact forces, and you'd have to decide how things hit and rub against each other. It gets very complicated. But okay, I'll stop there, and thank you. Sorry about running over, but I like to change stuff an awful lot.
Just a silly question. You mentioned polymers. Now, suppose you put a polymer on the end of a cantilever and start doing what you're doing.
Well, you can't yet. I mean, if so, of course, as soon as you say it's a polymer, then you're really thinking about seeing inside of some sort of solvent.
Well, I'm wondering if there was any way usually polymers are in solvents, all right?
Yeah.
Is there any way in which one can isolate a single polymer strand?
There,
the solvent would presumably provide drag.
Yes. But the way in which it's usually done is
that... Before you mention that, suppose you take a polymer in exactly at the feature point. Would that be... and then the polymer is a random coil. Would that help?
I don't think so. I can tell you what's done with more extended rigid polymers, biological polymers. And the what's done, just in terms of forcing, okay, so maybe if you made it very long, many persistence lengths, you could get it to do interesting things, is that optical traps are used. And so you drag it around by an optical trap, and they'll even put background flows and drag it around. And mostly that's to look at things like persistence lengths. You want to get things like effective Young's modulus and so forth out of it. But as far as doing something like this, somehow dragging around and trying to make it do things more complicated, I haven't seen anything like that.
Well, thinking you could, there are other polymers, I mean, like paint and so on. I didn't see why you just couldn't have a polymer in there. I mean, I didn't see what's wrong with
that. I'd be happy to talk about it.
The other thing I wanted to ask is, suppose you now did your flag problem and you put something like a circus.
So,
a membrane sheet.
Yeah.
You started flattening it up, and you started increasing the width of the.
We're doing that problem right now. We just bought a flow tunnel, a real flow tunnel, and it, 6-inch square cross section.
And you should get a crossover when it's very thin.
Yeah, that's right. So the test length is a couple of feet, and it's got a 6-inch square cross section, and we're going to try messing with that, putting in actually mylar sheets, because you can get them in different thicknesses, and so you can change the mass freedom length.
Last question is that I'm used to dealing with biological membranes where one talks about things like bending rigidity, curvature rigidity. Is there any effect of curvature rigidity in anything that you've done?
You mean a resident,
yes.
Curvature?
Right. We'll say spontaneous curvature.
Well, Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you could certainly put that into modeling by making the Young's modulus something that sits inside of the divergence, right? And so, yeah, you could, in principle, you could put in models for...
Whether you could do a
fraction. Yeah, whether you could do a fraction. Yes?
In your experimental setup, you said Reynolds numbers around 10,000. Is that something you try to control, or is that just the way it came?
So one of the difficulties with soap films is that you have to operate in a regime where you're not flowing so fast that you get basically shock waves that are moving through it. And if you run it too slow, the film breaks. And so you're in a rather restricted range. And so really you get to control this flow speed, as I said, on the order of really 2 up to, if it's a good day, to 5 meters per second. And that's about it. So in the Reynolds number, that's the scales linearly with length, say, and so that's the range you're looking at. Now, you might try, well, that's probably a bit too quick. If one used maybe different kinds of soap, you might have an opinion on that, but different types of solutions and so forth, maybe you could change the effective viscosity in some reasonable way. Yeah. And then change the Reynolds number that way. Other types of films. There's other freestanding films like Smectic films, but they're very, very sludgy. They don't move very quickly.
Just a quick question. I think maybe it's in line with the comments about the biological problems. But what are the applications of this?
Well, this stuff?
There must be some fascinating ones, but I can't like.
Well, people do worry about on the general question of the dynamics of inextensible strings. That shows up, for example, in satellite tether problems. So you have these two objects, and they're coupled by some sort of cable, which is basically an inextensible, flexible string on the length scales that you're looking at. And people do simulations and study those types of things. It's also a classic problem for looking at resonant instabilities, which show up in all sorts of physical problems. So, a specific application on this, I'm not so sure. On the flags, there's been some recent work by some engineers, and I'm probably going to get... I certainly don't remember their names, so I'll just have to tell you what they did. And what they've been looking at is making flags out of piezoelectric materials. And so a piezoelectric material is one that will produce a current if you start flexing it. And so what the Navy has asked them to do is to produce something which is a replacement for an underwater turbine, which turned out to be very unreliable over long term. So something that, say, would charge a battery slowly by flapping in a turbulent flow and producing a current and slowly charging the battery all the time. So certainly if you want to pick the material parameters right, so if you had something like a meme flow, if you had an estimate for that, you had an estimate of the rigidity, you could adjust that, then you could find out where you're always kind of in the unstable regime. So it would, I believe, have application in those types of things. Then there's the converse problem that if you apply a current, you can get it to flex. So there's going in the other direction. If you like, there's inducing a curvature. So you might think about making things like swimmers.
Okay, quick yes or no question.
Yeah.
When you do the resonant calculation for the chain, does the tension drop out when you do the flag?
No. So that's the base state. The tension the tension only shows up in the base state, though.
Same for flag?
Now, all right. So for the flag, the tension's not there because I haven't put in things that would produce tension, like gravity. So it's not it's no hanging piece in there. Yeah.
All right.
You mentioned about the stable state for the flags. Most flags sort of start from a position like that.
I can't quite see your hands there.
I know, but then instead of being the flag would have to be sort of horizontal.
Yeah, that's right.
Start in the stable state.
That's right. So we're kind of mimicking Rayleigh's stuff as well as we can.
Yeah.
So when you have something like this, right, then it's a bit more difficult because the flag wants to hang. So we're ignoring that.
Well, but could you do it vertically and then start the thing off, then you get a stable state for a real flag?
Yeah, if you could set your flow tunnel up to do that, yeah. That's right. If I understand your question, I think the answer is yes.
Okay.